We're going to read the Bible now, and Laurie is going to read to us this morning from Matthew chapter 2 on page 966. Let me give a bit of context, though, to this Bible reading before Laurie comes to read. So Matthew chapter 2. And the first part of this chapter is familiar to us. It's the story of the wise men coming and seeking Jesus out, following the star, seeking him out and worshipping him and presenting him with their gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. What we're going to read now is less well known and rather less Christmassy, but nonetheless it is part of the Christmas narrative. Thanks, Laurie.
Matthew chapter 2, starting at verse 13, page 966 in the Church Bible. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious and gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity, who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted, because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene.
Thanks, Laurie. Well, keep Matthew 2 open in front of you, and we're going to be exploring that this morning. It's a bit of a lead balloon, isn't it, after the joy and the wonder of what happened that first Christmas with the newborn baby, the shepherds, angels, the wise men. But Herod the Great's slaughter of Bethlehem's male infants is sadly what happened. And this is where the Christmas narrative becomes less family friendly. In fact, in this moment, the Christmas dream becomes nightmare. But the harsh reality of the darkness of this passage highlights the shining glory of the work of Jesus, the Son of God. Jesus' friend John once wrote in 1 John 3:8, "The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work." And in the midst of the darkness of Matthew 2, 13 to 23, we've got two powerful indications of how Jesus destroys the devil's work. But let's just get the story so far. There's Magi, wise men from Babylon, 550 miles east. They arrive in the capital of Judea, Jerusalem, saying, look at verse 2 of chapter 2. "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." King Herod the Great, appointed in 40 BC by Rome to rule Judea, he went ballistic. And the whole of the town was in commotion. Herod was a snake. And so rather than execute the wise men on the spot, he uses them as pawns to lead him to Jesus. So having found out from the religious leaders that their Messiah was prophesied to be born in Bethlehem, listen to his sickening instructions to the wise men in verse 8. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." And so the wise men head off. They find Jesus, they bow down, they worship him, they give him presents fit for a king. And we pick up the narrative in verse 12. And the first way that we see that Jesus appeared to destroy the devil's work, it's that the slavery of sin is broken by the exile of the Son of God. The slavery of sin is broken by the exiled Son of God. Look at verse 12. Having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they'd gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." So imagine it, this young couple with their toddler, they sneak out of Bethlehem in the dead of night. And Matthew tells us in verse 15, "And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" Matthew is saying ancient Old Testament prophecy was being fulfilled. And he's quoting there the 8th century BC prophet Hosea, who originally said this referring to God calling the nation of Israel out of slavery in Egypt in the time of Moses. The nation of Israel was at times referred to as God's son. And centuries before, they had fled to Egypt for their lives from a famine when they were just an infant nation, just a family. But there in Egypt, they grew into a vast nation. But they also became an enslaved nation. If you've seen the 1998 animated musical drama film by DreamWorks, The Prince of Egypt, it tells the account of God dramatically rescuing the nation of Israel from slavery in Egypt. And in the Bible, the early chapters of Exodus and the Old Testament record these historic events that propelled Israel from being a despised slave nation to being a free and powerful nation whose rescue from Egypt made them world-renowned and God's fame spread. God had called his son Israel out of slavery in Egypt with great acts of power, all the plagues on Egypt, and particularly through the death of the Passover lamb, where God's judgment fell on all the firstborn sons of Egypt, but the firstborn of Israel was saved as the Passover lamb died in their place. And that night, over 2 million sons and daughters of Israel were called by God out of Egypt and then led miraculously through the Red Sea, free from slavery. But Matthew, inspired by the Holy Spirit, applies this event to Jesus. Jesus fleeing to Egypt as an infant to escape death is fulfillment of prophecy, verse 15. "Out of Egypt I called my son." The history of Israel, God's son, is repeated in the life of Jesus, God's unique son. Just as Israel as an infant nation went down to Egypt, Well, so the child Jesus went there too. The difference is that whilst Israel was rescued from physical slavery in Egypt, Jesus came to rescue his people from spiritual slavery to sin. In fact, the New Testament pictures the transforming power of Jesus' work as breaking the chains of slavery to sin. Let me read to you from Romans 6, verses 16 to 18. It says this, "Don't you know that when you offer yourselves to someone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one you obey, whether you are slaves to sin, which leads to death, or to obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you have come to obey from your heart the pattern of teaching that has now claimed your allegiance, and you've been set free from sin and have become slaves of righteousness." That imagery there of slavery and freedom. Or Hebrews 2:14 says about Jesus, "He too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the and that those who lived all their lives were held in slavery by fear of death." So as God calls Jesus, his son, out of Egypt as an infant, to grow up in this world and live a perfect life and die on the cross for the sins of his people and to rise again to eternal life, well, those events, they're the reason why today he can call his people, his sons, his daughters, out of slavery to sin. Jesus pays the price for our sin. Think of it. Think of Jesus' exile in Egypt. Well, that happened at the beginning of his life, but at the end of his life, he suffered an exile on the cross as he is separated from his father's love, as he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he's forsaken so that all those who trust in his death for forgiveness might never be forsaken by God. So know this morning that there is power at the cross. Jesus' exile. There's power to break the power of sin. The slavery of sin is broken there. And God calls us today. He calls us to faith in Jesus for salvation and then to daily live by faith in him, so that we live in the freedom from the power of sin that Jesus died to rescue us for. If you're a Christian here this morning, today he calls you his child out of Egypt, out of slavery to sin, to walk in freedom because of Jesus' death on the cross. Maybe there are areas of your life this morning where you feel trapped in a vicious cycle of confession, of sin, confession, of sin, confession, sin, and it goes on. And that is so discouraging. And you can feel like giving up and giving in to the sins of your flesh. Maybe you've done that in areas of your life today. Well, hear again that Jesus came to destroy the work of the devil in your life. He did. The slavery of sin is broken by the exile of the Son of God on the cross for you. So there'll be different things that enslave us, and there are things that enslave each of us. What are they today? What sins have got you in their grip? Is it quarreling and fighting? Or jealousy and envy? Or stealing? Or complaining and criticizing? Being judgmental? Maybe it's sarcasm? Or gossip and slander? Or swearing? Or competitiveness? Or apathy and laziness? Or hatred and anger? Or lustful thoughts and lustful actions? Maybe it's drunkenness. Maybe it's cheating. Maybe it's procrastination or greed and materialism. Maybe it's pornography or sexual sins. Maybe it's perfectionism. I mean, the list could go on. All sorts of things enslave us. Don't let the enemy, the devil, further enslave you by convincing you that there is no forgiveness for whatever enslaves you, for such persistent sinners like you and me. Turn again from your sin. Confess again your sin. Come to Jesus again by faith, and again put your trust in what he's done for you on the cross. There is a warm welcome at the cross. Know that today he calls you his child out of Egypt, out of slavery to sin, to walk in freedom because of Jesus' death on the cross. Well, there's a second way that we see Jesus appear to destroy the devil's work in Matthew 2. First of all, the slavery of sin is broken by the exiled Son of God. But secondly, the sorrow of sin is healed by the suffering of the Son of God. Sorrow of sin is healed by the suffering of the Son of God. Look at verses 16 to 18. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. He gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Now Herod, he was one of the few rulers of Judea to succeed in keeping the peace in this hotbed for nationalist terrorism that was Judea. But he was ruthless. During his lifetime, he murdered two of his brothers-in-law. He assassinated two of his own sons. And he killed his own wife, Mariam. Scarcely a day passed without an execution at his orders. His cruelty was proverbial throughout the Roman Empire. Just before his own death, he ordered that one member of each family in his kingdom be executed on the day of his death to ensure a proper atmosphere of mourning in the land. Thankfully, those orders were never carried out. The Massacre of the Innocents was a 17th century painting by Rubens, and it depicts this act of state-sponsored terror that we've got recorded here in Matthew 2. And that picture graphically features Herod's sword-bearing soldiers rampaging through Bethlehem, screaming and slaughtered infants, distraught mothers. It's not a picture you'll find on any Christmas card. And you know, at the heart of Herod's sin was that his life was the me show. It was all about him. And it led to intense sorrow. Verse 18. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. It's a quote from the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah, who lamented for the mothers of Ramah. It's near Bethlehem. They're called Rachel here. I wonder if you noticed that. Rachel was the wife of Jacob, the founding father of Israel, and she was buried near Bethlehem. And in Jeremiah, they are mourning at the loss of their sons, as they tramped along the road in shackles through Bethlehem on their way to exile in Babylon in the 6th century BC. That's the context of that quote. Well, the same pattern is repeating itself now here in first century Bethlehem. As the mothers of Bethlehem now weep for their slaughtered sons at the hands of Herod the Great. The sorrow caused by Herod's sin here is unimaginable. And sin, life with me at the center, that we're all guilty of, always, always leads to sorrow. And it is something that Jesus, the Son of God, came to heal. The sorrow caused by our sin. He transforms our me-centered hearts. You see, far from escaping the sorrow of sin in Bethlehem down to Egypt, Jesus came into our world to experience that sorrow to the full. He came to heal it. Just look at verses 19 to 23. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. And so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. Now Matthew doesn't directly quote any single prophet in verse 23. He says about Jesus being brought up in Nazareth, so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, plural, that he will be called a Nazarene. And that is because it is not specifically prophesied anywhere in the prophets. Instead, what Matthew's doing is he's referring to the general thrust of Old Testament prophecy that says that the Messiah would come from obscure beginnings, from a despised place. The gospel writer Luke tells us that Mary and Joseph, they'd lived in Nazareth before moving to Bethlehem for the Roman census. But Nazareth was a backwater of a place. It had a seedy reputation. Jesus would be known as Jesus of Nazareth. That had all sorts of associations of a despised underdog place. For he will be the suffering, despised Messiah. As Isaiah the prophet said, he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. And so the question is, how is the sorrow of sin healed? By the suffering of the Son of God. How is the sorrow of sin healed? By the suffering of the Son of God. Well, perfectly in the age to come. In God's new heaven and new earth, when he will wipe away every tear from our eyes. But there is healing in part in this life. In part in this life, because when you and I, when we confess our sin at the cross, it changes our hearts. No longer can life be the me show. Instead, it's about Jesus. And the love of God that we experience in Jesus, well, it does bring a lot of healing into broken relationships. Not every relationship, but it does bring healing into our relationships. And it transforms what are often harmful and self-centered beliefs and lifestyles, and can bring so much healing to those around us. I want to try to illustrate one way that this happened in the first century. Whilst many people would have been shocked at the massacre of Bethlehem's infants in the first century, infanticide, that is, getting rid of babies when they're born, was broadly accepted. Abandoning infants, particularly baby girls, was common. And some historians estimate that the Greco-Roman world in the first and second century was as much as two-thirds male, partly to do with women dying in childbirth, but also to do with selective infanticide, getting rid of the girls. Influential philosophers such as Plato and Aristotle had supported the idea of selective breeding. So Aristotle once said, "Let there be a law that no deformed child shall live." But even healthy baby boys were frequently abandoned. If someone else wanted them, maybe to bring up as a slave, well, then it was finders keepers. What changed all that in the first century world? Well, it was Jesus. He had time for little children. He taught that unless you and I are utterly dependent on God, just like a little child is dependent on their parents, we cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. One secular historian calls Christianity the single greatest breakthrough against child abuse in history. And he was observing that the first Christian emperor outlawed infanticide in 315 AD and provided welfare so families didn't have to sell their children. Meanwhile, Christian sexual ethics struck infanticide at its source. So back then, ancient Greek and Roman men, they were licensed to have sex with slaves, prostitutes, and other vulnerable women. And that led to a lot of illegitimate children, leaving mothers destitute. Whereas Christianity demanded that men live faithfully with one woman for life and care for her and her children. Infanticide, it was like a moral blind spot. Something which society did. We look back on and go, oh my goodness, they did that? But at the time, it was accepted in that culture. But the gospel exposed it, and the gospel transformed it. And we need today the gospel to expose and to transform a different but similar blind spot that is on the conscience of the 20th and the 21st century. Tragically today, large-scale acceptance of abortion in the West has renormalized the termination of the most vulnerable of lives. While selective abortion of females in India and China has resulted in a huge gender gap of 25 million in India and 35 million in China. As Christianity has lost cultural control in the West, the personhood and the value of the most vulnerable unborn children has not only come into question, it's been denied. The World Health Organization estimates that worldwide there are an estimated 40 to 50 million abortions every year. That is 120,000 each day. And it's so normalized, it's so widespread, that most of us, we have been or will be affected by abortion, either having had an abortion or knowing those close to us who have had one or been affected by it. When my wife Jenny was 12 weeks pregnant with our middle child, Jasmine, we were told that our baby had a 20% chance of survival. And that if she did survive, then she wouldn't last very long, wouldn't live very long. And we were immediately given the option to abort her. And we were told that actually that was the kindest thing to do. I'm very thankful to say that once we made clear that that was not something we would contemplate, that was respected, and they did everything they could to save her. And in God's goodness, they did. But the devastation that it brings to families and to so many women and men is just huge. People who make that decision thinking it's the right thing to do, the kind thing to do. That was the pressure on us. Being told that, and actually being sold the lie that it's okay, and it is the right thing to do. And if it's Jesus' church, we're going to encourage people not to take that option. Then we need to make sure that as God's people, we support people who've made that choice. Who perhaps end up with a child that is very, very needy. How do we come around and support them? And for those who've made the choice to abort, how do we help them? Maybe you're here this morning, if you've been through that. We want to encourage you. Because it leaves deep scars of guilt, of shame. But there is forgiveness, there is wholeness in Christ on the back of abortion. It is part of the huge sorrow that comes as a result of the sinful brokenness of our humanity. But it is a sorrow that the Son of God, Jesus, came to heal through his suffering. In the words of the prophet Isaiah, he was pierced for our transgression. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. Not only is there forgiveness for every sin, as we trust in Jesus for forgiveness, there is healing for the sorrow that sin brings. Emotional, relational scars. We all live with those. Some of those we will live with to the day we die. But the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work in our lives. His work that tells us we can never be forgiven, or that God's not good, or that living for self is my right. Believe the devil's lies, and it leads to sin and sorrow. But the wonderful news is this, that the sorrow of sin is healed by the suffering of the Son of God, Jesus of Nazareth. And know this today, that he knows your suffering. He knows your sorrow. He suffered for your sin. So today, turn from your sin. Whatever it may be, we confess that and know the healing power of the cross. Healing that comes to broken relationships. Healing that transforms our harmful self-centered beliefs and lifestyles into something that honors him and puts him first. We're going to stop there this morning. Why don't we take a moment in the quiet? I'm aware what we've spoken of today is very personal, very sensitive issues. And if there are things that have touched your life today, why not speak with someone you came with today, one of our church family, or come and chat with me afterwards. I'd like to chat through further and perhaps pray together as well. Why don't we spend a moment in the quiet reflecting on what God is saying from his word to us this morning.